In that great Hollywood movie by Martin Scorsese, The Wolf of Wall Street, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Jordan Belfort, is portrayed as a master of the universe, someone like one of those ancient Greek myths where a mortal disports with the gods. Belfort builds a network of crime and illegality where he can do anything. He can trample over any law, any morals, any manners. And Belfort steals hundreds of millions of dollars from the poor, the ignorant, and the unwary. And his reward? Expensive cars, mansions, and a luxurious yacht. It's on this boat that a pivotal scene happens in the movie. Belfort, who is a real-life character, meets another real-life character, an FBI agent. And that agent is a man who takes the subway to work. He's a man who has a family. He's a man who has a salary and is just trying to do the right thing for the right reasons. And Jordan Belfort laughs at him. And that FBI agent, Greg Coleman, begins an investigation that will see the Wolf of Wall Street's criminal empire come crashing down. And today, Greg Coleman joins us on Crime Waves. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Crime Waves. I'm Declan Hill, and each week, myself and my students at the University of New Haven, and today it's Ryan Decker, we bring you an interview with one of the world's greatest criminal investigators. Now, many true crime podcasts concentrate on those so-called sexy crimes, you know, murders of the very rich or the Hollywood set. But here on Crime Waves, we pride ourselves on making sure that you, our listener, gets a chance to explore the full range of criminal investigation. And today, we're joined by one of the greats, Greg Coleman, who's a courageous FBI agent whose beat was Wall Street. And that's the home of financial opportunity, greed, and outrageous crime.
I remember watching The Wolf of Wall Street and then reading the books and stuff, and you see these scumbags stealing, and I'm sorry, that's a technical term, my dear students and listeners, for who these guys like Jordan Belfort were. These scumbags stealing the pension money of, you know, my grandmother or people like my grandmother, people who would put this cash away for years, decades, and then these hyper-fast, smooth-talking scumbags come in and steal it all. And that thin line between them and stealing the money is a guy like you. And there are just so few of you on Wall Street.
I agree. I don't disagree with you. I mean, there should be more of us. And remember, it's not even as if we've been doing this for a long time, right? The FBI has been around for a long time. That squad that I was on was created in 1992. And it was in response to the Drexel Burnham, Michael Milken, Ivan Boesky scandal, which, by the way, wasn't the FBI. That was done by postal inspectors, believe it or not. But that was sort of the push that got the FBI. It woke up the FBI finally to say, look, you know, civil regulation on Wall Street isn't enough. We need to have criminal prosecution. And then that's when the squad was created in 1992. It took some time for the U.S. attorney's offices to develop, you know, a group of prosecutors, because these are complicated crimes. And let me give you an example. For example, if I said to you, is it ever legal to buy or sell heroin in this country in any circumstance? Is it ever legal to do that?
I'd say maybe medically it's
no,
legal.
No, heroin. No, heroin. No, never. Right?
Never. Okay. All
never.
Right.
It's never. I mean, heroin, there's no circumstance where heroin is legal. It's an illegal substance, no matter what. So if you see somebody purchasing heroin, you know it's a crime.
Yes.
If you see somebody selling it, you know it's a crime. Is it illegal to buy or sell a stock?
No. it's totally legal to buy a stock.
No, that's the wrong answer. The answer is maybe yes, maybe no. Because, for example, the way you and I buy and sell stocks is completely legal. The way Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street, bought and sold stocks is completely illegal. You see? So you have an extra step with Wall Street-related crimes that you don't have in any other crime. First of all, you have to figure out, was it even a crime? Right? Because is it illegal to sell a stock that you don't own? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. In the legal sense, it's called short selling. You borrow the stock from somewhere else, you sell it before you own it, right? You borrowed it, you sell it, and you hope to buy it back at a lower price. Well, that's legal. But what if you don't borrow the stock and you sell it first and hoping to buy it back? Well, that could be illegal. An interesting example is what happened recently with GameStop, right? Did you see this, the run-up in GameStop price?
Yeah, I did. And my sense was, Greg, it was the little guys finally taking it back to the big guys at Wall Street. Is that right?
Yes and no again. Again, it's not a black and white answer. The answer is yes and no. Yes, it was them. But the problem is, they colluded together in the same way that Jordan Belfort used to collude together with other firms to purposely manipulate the price of the stock up. I mean, their intent was to take it to the hedge funds. And so by using Reddit and by using Wall Street Bets, by using the internet, they did exactly the same thing that Jordan Belfort would do by putting his brokers on the telephone and calling people. The point of him calling people was to get them to invest, and by them investing, that creates demand, and demand is what makes the price of a stock go up. Remember, at the core of every stock manipulation, every mortgage manipulation, every market manipulation is the simple concept of supply and demand.
All right, let me jump in there, Greg. Let me get right to the story, or at least one of the stories we're going to unpack today.
Sure.
When do you first hear about Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street? Do you remember, were you having a coffee? Sure. Was it a file that came across your desk? What was that moment when you first heard about this case?
Well, let me tell you how we got it. First of all, we created the squad in 1992. This is one of the first cases that came into the squad. And I say came into the squad because here's the way it came about. The Securities and Exchange Commission had already sued Stratton Oakmont for fraud. They sued him in, I want to say, roughly February or March of 1992. Okay.
That's the name of Belfort's company at that time.
That's the name of the Wolf of Wall Street's firm. Stratton Oakmont is the name of the firm. So they sued Belfort personally, along with his partner, Daniel Porish, who's played by Jonah Hill in the movie. And they sue the firm Stratton Oakmont, and they sue a couple of other small, non-relevant brokers for the purposes of the story. We get a referral from the Securities and Exchange Commission because basically we've told them we've created this group of investigators to do Wall Street crimes, and they refer the case to us. It comes into the supervisor, and the supervisor assigns it to me. So I'd love to say that it was some great work on my part or some great investigation on my part that brought it to me. But the reality of it was we were brand new. We were looking for cases to cut our teeth on. And this was one of the ones that came in. So that's how it came in. I mean, I wish there was a better story to tell that I was found this and that. But the reality of it is that's the way these things happen sometimes. At the time, do we know it's going to be a great big case? No, we have no clue.
And you didn't have a spidey sense as you're looking through the paper that this is going to be your life for the next few years?
No, I knew it would be a fun case. I knew it was going to be a fun case based on the kind of lifestyle he was living and the reputation he had at that point in time. He was really flashy. He was really, you know, out there with the money and the drugs and the hookers and the cars. And that persona was already out there in 1992 from the beginning, you know, the expensive suits, the expensive watches, the in-your-face attitude. It was there. So I knew it would be a good case. I had no idea whether it would be as big as it turned out to be, of course.
Now, before we go on, he doesn't actually sound all that different from the rest of Wall Street.
No,
he isn't. The expensive suits, all that kind of stuff.
Look, he isn't that different. He just did it a different way. He just put a spin on an old way of committing fraud. He just updated it, which is what criminals do, of course. We catch them, they adapt. We catch them, they adapt. We catch them, they adapt. It's an ongoing perpetual motion machine. It will never stop as long as there's money to be made. They just put a new spin on it. And that's all he did. He took an old fraud called a pump and dump, and he just changed it. He put some new bells and whistles on it and created a new fraud.
For the guys who are listening who may not know what a pump and dump is, just walk our listeners through what that is.
Yeah. Again, very basically, a stock goes up and down the price of it based on supply and demand. And so what you do in a pump and dump, if you want to get the price of any kind of commodity to go up, in this case, we're talking stocks. But if you want to get the price to go up artificially, what you do is you constrict the supply. You make it smaller and smaller, the supply of whatever the commodity is, while simultaneously increasing demand for it. Okay? So if it's oil, OPEC stops pumping so much oil. We still want the oil. The demand is there. The supply has gone down, right? And maybe if they do it at a time when we're going into the winter, when it's a very bad winter, the demand actually increases, but the supply has gone down. The price of oil goes up. Same thing with corn. Corn is grown in the Midwest. If we have a very wet spring where they can't plant, they have a smaller crop. The smaller crop is a smaller amount of corn. We still want corn. If the government says, well, we're going to use corn to make ethanol for fuel, that increases the demand.
Okay.
Supply and demand. And they all go up.
That's the legal thing.
But in a pump and dump, it's the same way. Belfort secretly takes control of shares of stock. He parks it in nominee names, people who are fronts for him. That's how he reduces the supply. Then what he did in his time frame was he had brokers get on the phone and call, dialing for dollars, they used to call it, right? That is what creates the demand. So he's constricting the supply by hiding the shares in nominees, in front companies, and in front individuals, while simultaneously increasing demand. The stock goes up. That's the pump. They're pumping up the price of the stock. They have a predetermined price that they're going to run that stock to. Okay. It can maybe go from $5 a share to $25 a share. When it hits 25, they start dumping their shares. Okay. They start dumping and dumping and dumping and dumping. That's the dump. It's a pump and the dump. And literally, if you see it, it goes up and it comes down. And if you look at the volume chart goes up and the volume comes down. If you go back and you look at GameStop, when it ran up, it's the exact, you can superimpose that chart over something that Belfort did. It's exactly the same.
Because
it moves up. And they dumped and they moved and it came back down. Now,
because what you're doing is you're selling when the market is right at the top, and then all the sense, quote, I'm putting in quotation marks here, the sensible investors go, holy jumping, there's nothing in this company. It's just an empty office in Philadelphia or whatever.
Well, the legitimate investors don't recognize that until it's all the way down at the bottom of the dump.
Yep.
It's too late. I mean, Belfort had his shares at the beginning at the very low prices, sometimes at zero. Sometimes his cost basis was zero, right? But when he ran it up to 25, the public is buying it at 25. Who are they buying it from? They're buying it from him. They're buying it from him at a cost basis of zero.
Greg, I wish as a Canadian, this wasn't a surprise, but we have something north of the border called the Vancouver Stock Exchange. Sure. Crikey, this happens so regularly on that place, with our mining investors. They call them penny stock pump and dumps. It's outrageous.
Well, I'm very familiar with, and by the way, many of the penny stock scams that occur in the United States, the basis of those are exactly what you said, Canadian mining companies that have gone public. I've worked directly with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police on cross-border stock frauds. So in both Toronto and
Vancouver. It's so embarrassing, Greg. it's so embarrassing being a Canadian, because you'll land in some like out of the way place, and you know three airplane changes, you land in Uganda or Azerbaijan or Northern Ireland or whatever. You open the paper, big mining scandal, and you're like, okay, where's the Canadians? Yeah, it's the Canadians again. It's everywhere. The Canadian boys are just anyway. Let's jump on. So Jordan Belford's file crosses your desk. Sure. What is it? What does a financial investigator do then? Like, what? Talk us through the first steps for an investigator. What do you do?
Well, you have to do what we call sort of your basic your initial,
what is that?
Your initial checks. For example, you run him through our computer, the NCIC, the National computer that the FBI runs, right? And you'll come up with any prior arrests that he may have. Maybe you want to speak to those investigators to see what they're about. In his case, he had some driving while intoxicated, those kind of things, but nothing that would add to the securities case. You learn about what are the stocks that he's manipulating. And remember, in a stock transaction, if you're manipulating it, you can't generally do it alone. You have to have co-conspirators. So who are the co-conspirators? Figure out who they are. Because what you're really doing in the beginning is, one, in a stock case, you're trying to figure out what is it that he did. Because remember, there are stock manipulations which can be very different from a stock fraud, a regular stock fraud case, right? A Ponzi scheme like Bernie Madoff, who recently passed away, right? That's a financial fraud. Stratton Oakmont is a financial fraud, but Stratton Oakmont was a stock manipulation. Bernie Madoff is not a stock manipulation. It's a financial fraud. So they're both financial frauds, but they're different. And even within stock frauds, there's different kinds. And so the first thing you need to do is figure out, what is it that you have? What is it that you think that they did? Because we can't just randomly pick brokers and investigate them.
Right.
There may be a few geniuses out there who think they can do that, but that's actually a violation of law, right? You can't just randomly pick people and decide that you're going. You have to have some predication. In our case, the basis of it was the Securities and Exchange Commission. They had already done their civil case. It ultimately didn't play much of a part in our case, but that's our basis to get into it. That's how we can get into looking at them. I do all my basic checks. I start putting together a list of who is it that I should interview, because an FBI agent's greatest role and his greatest skill is in interviewing people. And I think this is someplace nowadays where younger generations are having more difficulty. Why? Because their life is on the phone. Their life is texting. You can't interview somebody by texting. You need to speak to them face to face. You need to understand human beings. You need to understand human behavior. You need to learn how to read body language. You need to do statement analysis. You need to listen to the words, not just hear the words that they say, but listen to the words that they say and analyze those words, right? And so all of those things are very important. One of the things you learn from the very beginning when I trained agents, you don't do it by telephone. You never do it by telephone. You get in the car or you get on the subway, you go out there, you knock on the door, and you speak to the people face to face and go there. Because I can learn a lot about you by going to your home and interviewing you, or by going to your place of work and interviewing you, right? Okay, you guys, I have a background here. Everybody has a background. I can see you have books on your shelf. If I'm interviewing you, Declan, in that room that you're in, I guarantee you I'm going to read the titles of those books at some point while we're sitting there talking.
Oh, you should. They're some of my books.
I'll just
indicate them back. Yes.
Exactly. Right. And that's what people do nowadays. They put those up there to promote their. Okay. But I can also, if I go into your home and above your, on your wall are pictures of you in your sports uniforms and this and that, but there's no pictures of you with your wife or your kids. I know your wife or your kids aren't something of interest to you. Right. So conversations about your wife and kids are going to go nowhere. Remember, if I'm doing a witness interview, that is different, right? But if I'm doing an interview of who I think is a co-conspirator or a criminal,
yes,
I'm looking for their weakness. I'm looking for that thing, that little button that I can push that is going to get them to cooperate with me, to tell them the things that I want them to tell me. But remember, it's not so easy, because if they tell me what I want them to tell me, They're going to get arrested because they're co-conspirators. That's why I'm there to start with, right? And I'm going to always focus on sort of the bad guy rather than the witnesses or victims, because witnesses and victims are easy. You just ask them who, what, where, when, why, how. You get those. If there's nothing secret or complicated or even interesting in many cases about the victim witness interviews. The more creative aspects are when you're trying to get the criminals to talk to you. That's the harder
part. I've got a bunch of students here listening. Sure. I've got the university's media person who does interviews constantly, and I've got our listeners as well who really want to know. What is, aside from reading the room and reading their body language, what's the number one thing you bring to an interview of a co-conspirator?
Well, look, I think you bring, okay, if you want to be a great investigator, you know what skill you probably should have more than any other? You don't need to be a genius. You don't need to go to a big Ivy League school. You know what you need? You need to be inquisitive. You need to be genuinely inquisitive. If I put a chair in front of you and I said, come up with 50 questions about this chair, can you do it? Right? Some people get stuck at 3 or 4 questions. I can come up with 150 questions about a chair in a matter of minutes.
You know, it's really interesting you say this, Craig, because we had Pete Valentine, who's, like yourself, a law enforcement guy. He's a professor here at the university, and he studies blood spatters. That's what he's one of the world's experts in blood spatters at crime scene analysis. And so I asked him a very similar question, Greg. I said, you know, when you come to a crime scene, what's the best technique, you know, what's the best thing that you bring? Is it, you know, DNA, fingerprinting, blood splatter? Like, what is it? And he says, it's your brain.
Yeah.
It's that same thing that you're talking about. Like, you got to have an inquisitive mind. You've got to want to understand and know.
Right. I think the second most important skill, and this may even be the first most important skill, listening. We all love to talk. You talk for a living. I talk for a living. But I can also shut my mouth and I can zip it and I can listen for hours if I need to. Here's what I would say. Listening, believe it or not, it's harder. It's harder to do. It's hard to listen in great detail. I mean, to the level of detail where when you're interviewing somebody that you need to listen, because there's nuance. There's between the lines, there's these little tiny nuanced phrases and things that you need to watch for in conjunction with seeing the body language, right? And seeing the environment. But listening is hard. I mean, and it's a skill that everybody, including me, we violate the proper way of doing it. Sometimes we talk too much, we talk too long, but if there's one skill you should develop, it's that, because we're all very bad at it. But so when I would go out to interview somebody, I would go to their homes purposely. I want to see the environment. I want to see who interacts with them while they're there. I want to see who else is there. I often didn't have time to do proper research, which I don't recommend. But once you develop skills, you can sort of do these things on the fly. Of course, that's not recommended, but it's what I had to do many times, many, many times. I'm not an advocate of creating a list. I'm more an advocate of understanding the case internally, because what I find, and this I think is one of my biggest criticisms of the Securities and Exchange Commission, is that they create a list of questions. They go through the list of questions. They check off all the boxes, just as you're doing, but they don't listen to any of the answers. Why? Because they'll have a transcript typed up for them later, and they go back and they look at the transcript. Well, the whole point of asking a question is to get an answer. If you don't listen to the answer, what's the point? Because within the answer is 10 more questions, right?
It's those follow-up questions that are the key.
Absolutely.
Absolutely key. Absolutely. If I can jump in, because I think this is amazing wisdom for my students to hear. And this is going to sound sexist. I'm going to sound like I was raised in the 1700s in this politically correct world that we're living in here. But I generally suggest to my male students that they listen like a woman. And I find that women, when they're listening to me or when they're listening to people, are constantly kind of nodding, and they're creating an atmosphere of
listening, active listening. And I talk to my male buddies or whoever, and they've got a bit of a stony face, the poker face, and they're not giving up much. And I try to suggest to my male students, guys, watch that difference. It's not all women, it's not all men, but there's generally that gender bias, and learn that skill, learn that active listening skill.
Sure. And here's what I would say. Here's how I would comment to that.
Please, please. You are. And I know it's very sexist.
Well, but there's truth in what you say. And this is where going back to understanding human nature and human behavior, if there's about three or four things, if I had to do over in my career, I would focus on more. And one of them, I've always had a fascination with human nature and human behavior. If I had to go back again, I would have learned more about it early on. Some people have it internally. I'm one of those people who I recognized it. I don't know why I recognized it. I always knew it, but I didn't know the things that I knew until later when I read books and I realized, okay, this is what I knew all along, right? And I would have read those books earlier in my career. I would have been exposed to it earlier, and I could have used it even more. But I was always looking for a fair advantage. And if I know what you're thinking, or if I know where your mind is, I have an advantage over you. For example, just as I was speaking, you were nodding your head yes. So I know internally what I'm saying is resonating with you, right? If I'm speaking and you start going like this, I know you're disagreeing with me. When I originally started with that story about the Cayman Islands, I could see from the stage, based on his body language, that guy had a problem with me. I knew that. I knew way in advance, right? Because I could read him. I knew what was coming. So, you know, one thing I would advise is learn about human nature, human behavior, because it will give you a tremendous advantage in every aspect of life. But going back specifically to what you said about women and men, and I'm going to relate it to human nature and human behavior. If you put five men in a room, we will at some point start competing with each other. It's what men do. It's based in our DNA, okay? Because in the days of when we were all cavemen and cave women, right? We all wanted to fight for the cave woman, so we all competed with each other. We wanted to be bigger, we wanted to be stronger, we wanted to be faster, we wanted to bonk each other on the heads harder, right? That's the reality of it. And again, this sounds sexist, but there's 100 books out there. I'm not making this up. I didn't even do the research. It was other people who've done research on body language and statement analysis. But if you put generally, and again, there is no absolutes here, but generally you put five men in a room, we're going to start competing at some point, right? If you put five women in a room, they'll find a consensus. Their general instinct isn't to outdo the woman, one woman over the other, whereas with men, we do. Now, again, you may want to have Renee confirm whether this is the sense that she gets when she's in a room with five women. But I can tell you, I've been in a room with guys, and we compete yes. about everything, right? Whereas women will want to find they'll want to agree. They'll want to. They don't want to dispute. They want to work it out. They want to resolve it, right?
Craig, let me. And by the way, I do want, because I know our listeners want to get back to the Jordan Belfort story. Because we'll get back there once Greg and Declan have figured out all these gender stuff. But I just want to say, Lisa Daddio, who's a brilliant organized crime law enforcement from New Haven Police Service, and one of the major crimes that she helped solve was the disappearance of Annie Lay at Yale University back in 2009, which we've also got an episode on. And she was talking about that, having to deal with the egos of the different agencies working on one case and how to get the male ego out and everybody focused on, hey, how do we resolve this case? How do we bring it home? Greg, let's get back to Jordan Belfort. You've done the stuff. You've done the basics and things. What do you do then? Are you running wiretaps? I mean, how do you gather the information on somebody as big as him?
Let me just make one comment on what you just said before I move on, because I think it's very important. The Wolf of Wall Street is not my biggest case. I had a case that's much bigger than this, 5, 6, 7 times bigger than this, probably much more important than this. It was filled with giant egos, which hurt the case in the long run. I was able, I mean, I don't have an ego. I had enough work where I couldn't take on more work. egos are really dangerous in this profession. They exist. Anybody who says they don't is lying. And you're absolutely right. It can be very detrimental to a case. So when you have people who can put the egos aside, you will find great success. And when they can't put them aside, it actually hurts justice in the long run. Anyway, going back to Jordan Belfort. Look, so what we started to do was I needed to find what I would call as the crack in the armor. You know, I've said before publicly, I used to view Belfort and his henchmen as being inside a suit of armor. And I needed to just find the crack in that suit of armor and get inside there. And once we did, we would be successful. And that's what I did. I looked for different people who were involved in the transactions. You know, by the way, one of the first things you do is, of course, you subpoena records. You want to see the specifically, you want to see who's making money. Who were the ones in these transactions making money? Because if you're working on the premise that it's a fraud, it's a manipulation, victims don't make money in a manipulation. The bad guys do, right? So the number one thing you want to do is you have to do the analysis of the transactions, who's making money. And then once I did that, you look for the weakness there. Now, in our particular case, we focused on a man who was running another brokerage firm. He turned out to be one of Belfort's mentors, a guy by the name of Alvin Abrams. He was running a brokerage firm in the city, had been for years, since I think the 1970s. So he had been in business many, many, many years. And he was a guy who always ran with a crowd of sort of dirty brokers. And he was a guy that really helped Belfort get going. He not only taught him, but he participated in transactions. So I focused on him initially. And as part of the financial analysis, I noticed that there were withdrawals in his account, many of them, $2.3 million worth, as a matter of fact, all just below $10,000. Now, for those who may not know, there's a crime in the United States called structuring. And the reason for that is this. Let me go back one step. In the United States, you can deal in cash, any amount you want. There is no prohibition in dealing with cash. So if I have $500,000 in cash and I want to go and purchase a home or a boat, I can. There is no prohibition. The only requirement is that transaction has to be reported. If it's over $10,000 in cash, it has to be reported. Okay. So if I'm buying a car or a house or a boat or making a deposit or making a withdrawal, if I'm taking $15,000 in cash out of my bank account,
the bank has to report.
The bank has to file a form.
But so, if it's $9,990.
Right. So when the government passed the law, and you'll see that this always happens, the government has to use very specific thresholds. They chose a threshold of $10,000. So the bad guys started doing transactions at $9,999 to avoid having the form filed. Then the government caught up. Remember, I said it's this constant perpetual motion machine. The government caught up and said, well, wait a minute. We're asking for the data because it's useful to stop money laundering and criminal activity. You're now preventing us from getting the information, so we're going to make what you're doing a crime too, in addition to making you file a form.
And that's structuring.
And it's called structuring. So he was taking, this broker, Alvin Abrams, was taking out of his account 9,800, 97, 96, 99, 98, 95, 97, 96, to the tune of $2.3 million. Okay. Now, what does that have to do with Jordan Belfort and securities fraud? At first, I have no idea. And it doesn't even matter to me because I know he's committed a separate independent crime that I can prove very easily. Why? How do I prove it? Well, if you look at his account, if he took out $9,800 Monday through Friday, could there be a legitimate reason for doing that? Well, most people will say, well, maybe he didn't have enough to take it all out at one time. So look at the balance in the account. If there's $1 million in the account, you could have taken the 9,800 times five at one time, right? So why take it out over 5 days? There was no justification. So I know he's structuring. Okay, that's called leverage.
So now you got that. And so do you work on flipping him? Is that the crack in the armor?
As I just started to say, that's the crack in the armor. It's not necessarily securities fraud. I don't know if it has anything to do with the securities fraud, but I know I can arrest him, and I do. I charge him with structuring. Now, what I ultimately learn is that cash was being part of it was being kicked back to Jordan Belfort. In other words, Jordan Belfort and Al Abrams were doing stock deals together. Al Abrams was making the money in his accounts. He would take a portion of that money out as cash and kick it back to Belfort. It was a very interesting formula, the way it worked. Here's the way it would work. Let's say Al Abrams made $1 million. Okay. They would take 50% off the top, because Al Abrams had to pay taxes on the money. And at the time, tax rates were much higher. So let's say he takes 50% off the top. So we started at $1 million. We're now down to $500,000. From the $500,000, Al Abrams would keep 25% and Jordan Belfort would keep the other 25, right? Because 25, 25 plus 50 equals 100. So that means 25% of the $1 million, $250,000, would be kicked back to Belfort in the form of cash. He would literally bring him bags of cash.
Okay? So you've got him. You've got this guy. How, Greg, as an experienced agency guy, federal FBI guy, how do you flip somebody?
Well, there's two ways. One is if you have other criminal activity or you have them involved directly in what you're investigating, you can charge them. For example, in Belfort's case, how did I flip Belfort? I flipped Belfort by charging him with like 23 counts of money laundering and securities fraud, and he was facing 23 to 27 years in jail. That's how I flipped him. He flipped right away. He understood the system. He was smart enough. But in some cases, you want to flip people before you arrest them, because you want them to work with you covertly. You want to debrief them and not have the other bad guys know that you're debriefing them, right? So that's where persuasion comes into play. That's where knowledge and human nature and human behavior come into play. Because if I go knock on Declan's door at 5 o'clock at night one evening, and you know that you're a criminal and you know what you've done, and I need to convince you, well, you better start talking to me, because at this point in your life, I've got enough on you where it's better for you to come work with me than it will be to fight me, right?
Right.
So that's where a lot of persuasion comes in. That's where understanding human beings and knowing which buttons to push comes into play. Because by you cooperating, you're essentially implicating yourself.
And do you need to approach a meeting like that with, say, me or another quote potential criminal different than you would do an interview? Is your body language different? Is the way you talk to these guys different?
Yes and no. Okay. I basically, a couple of things. First of all, I never bluff. I never BS'd people. I didn't say that I had evidence if I didn't have it.
Right.
I think it's much easier to put the unknown out there and make them think on their own and make them try and guess what it is that you have, rather than saying, you know, a lot of agents will walk in, you see on Law and Order, the guy points his finger at him and he starts yelling. Okay, number one, that does not work. Does not work in the real world. You go up to some mafia guy and you start pointing your finger at that, he's going to jump up, and next thing you know, you're going to be into a fight or a scuffle. It doesn't work. And the more intelligent people are, the less it works, right? Because they know they have the right to counsel. So my approach was always low key. My approach was more of the frog in the water, where you put him in when it's cold and then you boil the water and he never see. That was my approach. And I did it for a couple of reasons. One, my approach always fit my personality. I'm not an in-your-face kind of guy, even with the guy in the Cayman Islands. That's about as aggressive as I get with people, right? Thumping the dollar bill on the guy's chest. That's about as aggressive as I get, because I don't think aggressive. I'm not a big guy. If I was 6'5" and 250 pounds, it might work, but I'm not. So I don't use that. I would rather do it softly and they never see it coming, because what I'm going to do when I go in there is I'm going to start interviewing him.
Right.
And again, at that point, I know he's involved in it or she's involved in it. And I have, evidence, but I want to do it quietly. I will slowly turn it into an interrogation.
Interesting. There's a scene, and I know you've done a plethora of other cases, many of them much more important than this, but my listeners and myself have seen The Wolf of Wall Street, or and there's a scene where you meet Belfort on a yacht.
Right.
And he's arrogant and he's full of himself, and you are just was that a true scene? Was there a similar scene actually in real life like that?
Yeah, and it comes down to yes and no is the answer. Here's the thing. Did that really happen? Did I go onto a yacht? No. The answer is no. Was Belfort planning to do that? Absolutely. He was going to bring me onto the yacht. He was going to try and subtly bribe me to make the case go away. The reason he didn't was he had done some homework. He had probed around to different people. He found out that I was not the kind of guy who would play that kind of game. But I'll tell you why that's such a good scene in the movie. I sat down, I reviewed the script. The FBI allowed me to review the scripts on the parts that I was in, my character was involved in. And I said, yes, this is based on what Belfort was going to do. But the way they had it written was terrible. And I said, this is terrible. I would never do these things. I would never say these things. And they said, well, what would you do? So I literally sat down in a conference room at the FBI with Kyle Chandler, the actor who plays me in the movie. And I told him what I would do. And I said, I would play this little game of cat and mouse. I would lure him in. I would get information out of him. And at the end, I'm not going to play his game. And so Kyle Chandler improvised from those discussions that we had. They wrote it into the script. And it ultimately is, one, in my opinion, one of the best scenes in the movie. The reason being, in my opinion, is it's probably reflects my attitude when I was doing investigations the best. The style of what you see him doing there is the way I used to do it. I mean, playing that little game I loved playing that little game there. I would ask honest, legitimate questions. I would never bluff. I would never lie, because if they call my bluff and I don't respond, then they win. They have power over me, because then they know I've lied to them at that point. And if I've lied once, I'll lie again. Right.
And you've lost your moral credibility. Exactly. Again, you've got the chink in the armor of Jordan Belfort. And there's a moment when you're going to arrest somebody, the Lamborghinis are stacked up, they're a state in Hampstead or whatever. And you've got the guys, and you're going to go in and arrest. Tell us what that moment is like when you're standing outside at 6 o'clock in the morning or wherever. What are those scenes like?
Well, in Belfort's case, I can't tell you, because I'm not the one who actually arrested him, believe it or not.
All right.
We had gotten some source information at the time we had the arrest warrant. When we obtained it, I reached out to a couple of human sources that I had. They told me that they believed he was going to be at a particular place conducting a meeting for his new business that he was involved in. I went to that location with a couple of other agents to pick him up. I sent a couple of agents to his home to just basically sit outside there, with instructions not to arrest him if they see him coming and going. But the agents felt at that time that it would be better to arrest him. So when he came out, the other agents actually arrested him. So I wasn't there. I actually didn't arrest him. Basically, he was coming out with his daughter to go to Blockbuster to take out some videos. And they stopped him and brought him back into the house and placed him under arrest. And of course, we came over from the location where I was. I wanted him to cooperate on the spot. I knew he would probably cooperate. Unfortunately, it was, I don't remember what, well, it was in September. So it must have been Labor Day weekend. It was right before Labor Day weekend. He couldn't reach his attorney. And so ultimately we had to lodge him in the jail for a couple of days. until after the holiday, and his attorney got back, and then from there he ultimately decided to cooperate. And so we debriefed him, and by the way, we arrested Danny Porish on the same day or the next day down in Florida. They both decided to cooperate right away based on the size of the charges against them, which, again, let me just address that very quickly, because things have changed significantly in the world of stock fraud and securities manipulation. When I was doing these cases, the court system and prosecutors really, and even many agents, didn't view it as like real crime. It was not a big deal. And so I would routinely make $20, $30, $40 million fraud cases, and the defendants would get 3 years of probation. They wouldn't even get jail time. Now, that was one of the reasons why I started beefing up my cases with money laundering charges. And in Belfort's case, it was perfect because he moved the money overseas through shell companies. And so it fitted perfectly. But it also, it boosted the sentencing guidelines, the amount of time that these guys could get if they were convicted. Belfort was facing, I think, 23 to 27 years. If he had not cooperated, if he had gone to trial and was convicted, the judge at the time was obligated to sentence him between 23 to 27 years. His only way out, his only way of saving himself, was to cooperate, which is what he and Danny Porch decided to do. When we arrested them, me and one or two of my colleagues basically used both of them for about a year covertly, making cases against other co-conspirators. We made telephone tapes. We made in-person body recordings. We did surveillances with them. We did meetings with them. We did, you know, money laundering payoffs where people were literally bringing bags of cash, and or Belfort was bringing what he was representing as bags of cash to them to launder. And then we would arrest them sort of like a buy bus type thing, except for money laundering.
That's very interesting, Greg, because that, you know, he's basically working for you as a foot soldier of the FBI for a year, bringing another crook. You never see that in the films. You never see that discussed. Let me ask you, as we wrap up this interview, what has surprised you the most as an investigator in this?
Let me just go back to how it's changed. They enhanced the sentencing guidelines. They increased securities fraud. And this all came about after the WorldCom and Enron and those frauds when they came about. And of course, 2008 just confirms it. Securities fraud now has a stronger penalty than money laundering. So that's how much it's changed. Right. They also has, as I mentioned earlier, there are at least two squads of agents in New York who do this. There is a full complement of prosecutors in Eastern and Southern District that know how to do these cases. So it's a completely different world. Remember, it was a brand new world when I did it. So let me go back and ask you to repeat your last question there. What was that question?
What has surprised you?
About what? What aspect? The case in particular, or law enforcement in general, or?
In terms of, you know, when you look back at the big cases, was there one thing that just like, whoa, this really knocked my socks off in terms of a surprise? Because I want our listeners to understand that world where suddenly things are coming at you that you wouldn't have imagined. You thought you prepared for everything, and then there's something coming that side of you.
Well, that's actually every day. I mean, in these big cases, beyond every turn is another surprise. Sometimes people randomly walk in and start cooperating. I mean, we have disgruntled wives walk in all the time, right? The husband's been cheating for years. He's been scamming for years. He's divorcing the wife. He's cheating her out of money. She's fine. You're not going to give me the money. Then you're going to go to jail. And they walk in the door. So you never know. Like, you literally, one of the greatest aspects of this job, if you're a very regimented person and you must do the same thing every day in the same way, it's not the job for you. Because you could literally go in on Monday and not go home until Thursday because of things that happened when you got to the office on Monday. You just never know. Now, I volunteered for New York for just those reasons. I wanted to be in the big game. I wanted to be in the big city. Okay, I was a white-collar agent. During my career, I've smashed in doors on the Latin Kings, you know, Spanish gangs. I've done that. I worked on the plane crash, TWA 800, that crashed off of Long Island, the 747 that crashed. I've worked on World Trade Center for 9/11. I was in the city. So even though I was a white collar investigator, because New York is so big, because you need so many people to do some of these cases, you're brought in on other cases. And you get to work all kinds of large scale investigations and violations.
Awesome. Greg, two things. One is, I guess, you got to be prepared to be surprised every day. And the second thing is, can you please come back on our podcast? Can you please? I mean, let's just unpack some of these amazing stories. Would love this.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much. I'm going to turn now, Ryan, you've done an enormous amount of preparation, which of course, being a, having screwed this up, I didn't take enough attention to it. So can, are there questions that you'd like me to ask Greg?
Not really in particular. One, not like really question, but kind of a clear up. So sure. I know you and Jordan Belfort are like, I guess, acquaintances, friends. And I know you, on his podcast, you guys talked about how when he was working for you, he slipped over a note and it was ultimately like your choice to not put him in jail for 20 plus years. Is that like what happened?
Sure. The note, let me tell you, and here, let me tell you one thing quickly about the movie. First of all, about 75% of it is accurate. 25% of it is either made up or it's changed. And one of the big things that, Hollywood seems to do, and they have to do, right? Because in this case, it's a 3-hour movie, which is incredibly long for movies nowadays. But they compress the time frame sometimes, or sometimes they substitute different people. The note scene is real. It really happened, but it didn't happen the way that it does in the movie. Because here's what happened. I developed quite a number of cooperating witnesses along the way. Some of them we charged, some of them we did not. And by the time that scene in the movie comes up, I've got a number of people working for me that Belfort has no idea about, no idea. So he was, you know, he could be having daily conversations with that person, which were being recorded by us, and, you know, about criminal activity and things like that. And in this case, when I do arrest Belfort, I have to make a decision. Is Belfort really going to cooperate with me, or is he going to try and play me, right? Is he going to think he's smarter than I am? And that by that time, I was also tired of chasing him, and I wanted to cut to the chase. I wanted to go after the big people. So I sat down and I thought about this for a day or two. And I decided that, you know, and by the way, when Belfort starts cooperating, we debrief him. We create a list of people that he gives us information on. And those are the people we're going to focus on. So it's not like I'm pulling a name out of somewhere and saying, hey, let's go target that guy. These are people who were involved in the crimes. And one of the people who was involved was Belfort's best friend. And I thought to myself, look, the only person who was involved that would be worse than Belfort would be his father. Or his wife. And I can ask him to cooperate against them, but chances are he's going to say no. And his wife has a spousal privilege anyway, although there might be an exception, a crime fraud exception to that. And so I pick his best friend. And I say to myself, again, trying to analyze his human nature and human behavior, I say, if he's willing to wear a wire against his best friend, and get his best friend to discuss criminal activity that they've been involved in, then I know he's on board and I know he will be a good cooperator. And so what happens is we set up a meeting in a restaurant because that's where they generally would meet. We wanted it to mirror history. We wired Belfort up. He took a prospectus for the Steve Madden deal, you know, the shoe guy, Steve Madden. We took that prospectus, that offering registration statement for that deal. And he took it to the dinner. And during the course of that dinner, and by the way, we also have a transmitter on him, so I could sit outside in my car and listen to the conversation on a real-time basis. And what I hear is this. I'll just give you the guy's first name. It was David. He goes, Dave, you remember when we did this with Steve Madden? And what he does is he takes the prospectus and he slides it across the table. And he says, he tells him, he says, look, Dave, go to page 15. remember when we gave those shares to Steve and we did this? And Dave turns around and what I hear is, I don't know what you're talking about. I never did that. Why would you say that? He goes, yeah, he goes, didn't we do that? And Dave goes, no, we never did that. What are you talking about? Right? Now, I think that Dave is just suspicious of Belfort and he doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to say it out loud. In reality, what happened is when they brought Belfort his drink, you know, he orders like a tonic water or whatever. He takes the napkin. He writes on the napkin, don't incriminate yourself. I'm wired. And he puts it in the Steve Madden prospectus. So when he slides it across the table, he tells Dave, go to page 15. Dave flips up to page 15 and he sees the note and he doesn't say anything. So we have a 2-hour conversation of nothing of value, right? And, you know, we had people surveilling the meat inside the restaurant, but you can't really stare at people. And he did it in a very, and they were writing the whole time. So we couldn't know. Here's what happens for real, though. Dave leaves the restaurant. He's stunned by the note that Belfort has passed him. Don't incriminate yourself. I'm wired. So he knows now Belfort's working with the feds. He calls another guy and he says, you're never going to believe what just happened. I had dinner with Belfort. He passes me this note. He's working with the feds. He's a snitch, blah, 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 blah. Except the problem is the guy Dave is talking to is already working for me and has been working for me for years and nobody knew it. So within 24 hours, we pick up the phone and we tell Belfort to come in with his attorney and he does. And we sit him down and we say, don't say anything. Don't say a word. Just sit there and listen. And we say, we wired you up yesterday. You had dinner with Dave. You passed Dave a note saying, don't incriminate yourself, you're wired. You're done. We're ripping up your agreement. Now, what that means for him is 23 to 27 years, right? What that means for me is, holy crap, I did a lot of work. This guy's connected to a lot of people, and I'm going to have to make those cases in a much harder, much slower way. And so I knew the guy had to take a hit for it, and he did. I think we made him plead guilty to obstruction of justice, and that was an additional charge against him. But they also, we notified the court, and the court contemplated removing his bail requirements and basically throwing him in jail, which meant, of course, that I couldn't use him in a proactive basis. Remember, I have a list of people that he's been cooperating against during our debriefings. And some of them are very big fish. And I can only get to those people at this point by having him on our team. So we made him take the hit for it and he deserved it. He deserved to take an additional charge for that. And I think it was a very good thing to happen. And I think it was a very good thing to happen right at the very beginning. Because remember, this was the very first time we used him. And here's why I think it was good. It woke him up. It slapped him out of his reality, his phony world where he could do anything he wants. And it woke him up to the real life of what he was facing, 23 to 27 years, and that we weren't stupid and that we weren't going to play games and that we had power over him. And I think it was good because from that point forward, he became a really good cooperator. He got very good at what he was doing. And of course, it allowed us to make a second and third wave of cases, all of which the individuals pled guilty to, except for two individuals. They both went to trial and they were both convicted. So so that happened, but it happened a little bit differently.
Great.
As a basis. So,
great. This is awesome. Thank you so much. Hey, it's Declan. Thank you for listening to Crime Waves. It was an absolute honor for me to be able to speak to an investigator like Greg Coleman. And if you like this episode, please do the usual social media stuff, like and subscribe. and we'll see you for the next episode of Crime Waves.